This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Thursday, the Australia-China trade war escalates. We find out how some producers are thinking outside the box to find new export markets. And from random thoughts to online trolling to acts of violence, security agencies are increasingly worried about the threat of right-wing extremism.
If we are able to predict violence from online activity, we can improve our ability to prevent and mitigate the effects of terrorism and extremism.
First today, Beijing is firing another salvo at Australian exporters, adding wheat and lamb to its hit list amid the worsening trade dispute. Australian primary producers export 70% of their output, and 28% of that goes to China. The federal government is warning there are now big risks in doing business with Beijing, but some exporters are trying to get ahead of the curve and pursue other markets. Gavin Coote reports.
Australia's biggest export market is getting more volatile by the day. Cotton, beef, wine and coal are just some of the commodities being caught up in trade disruptions with China. And we can now add lamb and wheat to that list. Trade Minister Simon Birmingham says China is becoming a risky place to do business in.
Well, for all Australian businesses, any export proposition, any business proposition for that matter, is one of balancing risk versus reward. And through the course of this year, unfortunately, the risk of trade with China has heightened considerably.
It's feared Australian honey, vitamins and fruit could be the next export products that Beijing targets.
We have seen a pattern of behaviour this year, and it's an unacceptable pattern of behaviour. It does not appear to be consistent with either the letter or the spirit of the undertakings that China made in the China-Australia Free Trade Agreement or their commitments to the whole world through the World Trade Organisation.
The Chinese embassy has responded to the Trade Minister's remarks. It's accused Canberra of using ambiguous national security fears to block investments. And Beijing says it has a legitimate reason to hold up lamb exports because of COVID-19 infection controls. Meat industry analyst Simon Quilty.
And keep in mind that Australia in this situation is with many, many other countries in the same boat.
But some industries are looking to avoid the chaos altogether.
You'd be very hesitant to do any more business into China at the moment, just given the political risks that exist.
That's Brett Donoghue, who's the export manager of New South Wales-based grain marketer Agricom. Farmers could rely on a healthy Chinese appetite for Australian grain, until Beijing slapped tariffs on barley and hinted it could also block wheat exports.
Growers are very aware of where their wheat is going. So if you take away that market, it's very disappointing and takes a bit of cream off a very lucrative export market. So the Chinese market has been paying a premium for sorghum as well. But, you know, obviously the industry and the participants are very hesitant to be doing too much business forward. We have those risks, and unfortunately, everyone has to be very careful about monitoring their own risk because anything can change at a moment's notice, as we've seen with other agricultural products.
And while relations with China remain precarious, Brett Donoghue says grain growers are looking at other markets.
We're very competitive into Southeast Asia, which is really good news given our exportable surplus, particularly off the East Coast this year. I guess the one issue with China is that generally they had a larger appetite for high protein wheat, and given the way the season has gone this year, the quality of the crop is excellent. So generally speaking, China would have taken a fair chunk of that. So yeah, a bit disappointing in that respect, a lost opportunity, but we do have some very strong and robust demand into Southeast Asia, which is the good news.
Does it feel as though the harm here might actually be self-inflicted if they're missing out on that product this year?
Oh, definitely. There's no question about that. The Chinese have obviously been buying wheat from the US and other destinations, and also barley from France, which is our traditional market. Before the tariff, we were obviously doing a large volume of barley into that market, and now that's disappeared, and the French have actually benefited from that. So there's no question that they're probably doing themselves a bit of a disservice.
Australian exports of iron ore, which China needs for its construction industry, remain untouched at this point.
That's Gavin Cooch reporting. Well, the National Farmers Federation says it's vital for Australia to uphold free and fair trade, and it's urging industries to keep diversifying their markets. NFF President Fiona Simpson joins me now. Fiona, is it possible for Australian commodity groups to get by without the Chinese market?
Yeah, look, absolutely it is. It's going to be a huge hit, and people at the moment are feeling the pain. As we just heard, you know, China has traditionally paid a premium for the sorts of products it wants when it wants those products. And as a grain grower myself, you know, you can see physically when China is in the market in terms of some of the sorghum prices, for example, or the barley prices. So people are going to feel the pain and they're feeling it in their hip pocket. But by the same token, Australia is, you know, we have worked very, very hard ways, you know, since the 70s, really, when the UK joined the EU, and we felt some pain then, to diversify the marketplace, to make sure that we have a variety of markets for our goods, and that obviously we have a variety of goods we can offer to those markets. So whilst China is out of play, then we need to focus very much on those other markets. We need to expand some of the newer ones. We have some markets in our near neighbours, for example, Indonesia, Vietnam. We have some older markets like Japan. We need to keep looking at all the opportunities we have in these different marketplaces to take our goods, whilst acknowledging that there is certainly going to be some short-term pain for us.
And Fiona, in a practical sense, how easy is it to reshuffle if China decides to get a particular commodity from another country and it leaves a gap then open for us in another market? How long does it take to turn things around and be able to capitalise on that alternative market?
Well, at the end of the day, we have to sell what we produce. And our product, we're lucky enough that our product is so highly regarded across the world that we are able to deliver very much what we say and stand by our product. So at the end of the day, if there's a gap, then I'm confident that our exporters and our traders are able to move reasonably quickly to fill that gap. But it may or may not be at the same price, giving us the same premium that China was offering last time it was in the market.
With some commodities, I know in wine and horticulture and other areas, there have been very strong relationships built up between the Australian producers and the Chinese importers. How valuable are those relationships, and will it take a long time to establish them somewhere else?
Well, they're very valuable. And I know right now people are actually despairing on both sides because the relationships are strong and they go back many decades. And what's happening now, Sally, is much bigger than beyond any of our control. And people are really despairing on both sides that these relationships are having to break down for the moment because of bigger geopolitical factors. And I'm sure that at some stage we'll be able to build them up again, but certainly the way that we do business in many of our Asian and neighbouring countries is through forming good relationships. Trade is about win-win. It's a win for that country. It's a win for us. That's what our Chinese-Australian relationship has been over many years. So I'm sure those relationships will endure whatever hiccups we're having now. But in the meantime, we do have to look elsewhere.
Fiona Simpson, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks, Sally.
That's Fiona Simpson, the president of the National Farmers Federation. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. With the country's daily death toll nearing almost the 3,000 mark, the United States is desperately waiting for a COVID vaccine to be released. But the UK's jubilation at being the first country to roll out a clinically approved coronavirus vaccination has been dampened by the news that two health workers have suffered severe allergic reactions to the jab. The country's health authorities are now warning people with a history of allergies to avoid the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. Samantha Donovan has more.
Several thousand Britons have been given their Pfizer-BioNTech jabs at hospital clinics around the nation. The head of the UK's medicines regulator, the MHRA, revealed the allergic reactions while testifying before a parliamentary committee. She's Dr. June Raine.
We know from the very extensive clinical trials that this wasn't a feature, but if we need to strengthen our advice now that we've had this experience, in the vulnerable populations, the groups who've been selected as a priority, we get that advice to the field immediately.
The allergic reactions were suffered by two healthcare workers and happened soon after they'd had their shots. The BBC reports they'd had anaphylactoid reactions, which usually involve rashes, breathlessness and occasionally drops in blood pressure. That's not the same as anaphylaxis, which can be fatal. They were treated quickly and are said to be okay now. Both the workers are reported to have had histories of serious allergies and carry adrenaline pens with them. The UK's Chief Medical Officer, Chris Whitty, told the Parliamentary Committee it's not unusual for side effects to emerge even after Phase 2 and Phase 3 clinical vaccine trials.
But extremely rare but important issues, inevitably you accrue more information over time. And the NHS, through to the MHRA, is in a very good position to make sure that we can pick things up quickly, identifying them, communicate them widely, ensure that we improve practice.
Professor Magdalena Plobanski is a vaccine expert at RMIT University. She thinks most of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine's components are unlikely to have caused the allergic reactions.
The simple things like sugar and salt and the modified messenger RNA, which is the one that encodes the viral spike protein from SARS-CoV-2 as well. It's reasonably unlikely to be causing a reaction. What may be more likely perhaps to cause a reaction, and some people may cross-react to this, are some of the lipid components. Lipids are like grease, and they're the little droplets of grease that are encasing the RNA to protect it from being degraded.
Should the possibility of these allergic reactions have been picked up in the clinical trials?
The problem with the clinical trials that have been run thus far is that they are run very quickly on a large scale, and they have not really tested all the potentially vulnerable groups separately because of the speed of the development. So as vaccines get deployed more extensively, we are likely to find some concerns emerging because they have not really been tested in all the different type of vulnerable groups.
So do you think the UK trials of the Pfizer vaccine were done too quickly?
No, not too quickly. They were done appropriately.
Do you expect that Australia's regulator, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, will now be looking at this issue closely when evaluating the Pfizer vaccine?
Yes, absolutely. I would say the good news in some ways is that there aren't many suspects within the vaccine to test as to what could be the culprit causing this. And in fact, it may even be possible to test individuals before being given the vaccine, whether they have this cross-reactivity or any potential susceptibility. So it's probably going to be one of the safest vaccine deployments in history by the time we're done with it.
That's Professor Magdalena Plobanski from RMIT University. Samantha Donovan reporting. Well, doctors in Indonesia fear that the health system there could collapse under the strain of rising coronavirus infections. In Java, some hospitals are almost full. The number of cases has surged in recent weeks to new highs, and authorities fear there will be another rise in January after the Christmas New Year holiday. Indonesia has received the first doses of a Chinese-made vaccine and hopes to roll it out next month to health workers on the front line. Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
When young nurse Lydia Asmira married 6 weeks ago, it should have been the start of a long, happy life with her new husband. But with COVID-19 raging through the Indonesian population, she fell ill soon after, and 11 days after the wedding, she was dead. Her mother died the next day, her father 3 days later. I told them delay the reception till things improve, but she insisted and so did our parents, says her sister, Nuramani. I feel so sad, devastated my sister is gone, then my mother, 2 days later my dad. Lydia Asmira is one of 340 nurses and doctors who've died from coronavirus since the pandemic began in Indonesia. daily figures show the scale of the crisis is worsening. One doctor, Sajono Utomo, admitted himself to hospital last week, struggling to breathe. But there wasn't a single ventilator in the entire town in East Java, and he and his wife died on Friday. Another doctor, Hyrule Hardy, sick on a ventilator in an ICU ward, made a desperate plea for blood donors. I urge all COVID survivors to donate your blood so the plasma can help treat those with severe symptoms, he said. Indonesia is desperately short of ventilators and beds. Social media is dotted with posts of Indonesians begging for help for dying relatives, but many hospitals are almost full. We need to be aware of the possibility of our health facilities collapsing, says Dr. Irwandi, a hospital management official in Sulawesi. He says Indonesia needs more specialist hospitals in cities outside the capital. We only have one hospital for infectious diseases in Indonesia, in Jakarta, he said, but there's a huge chance of another pandemic in the future, so the government must build more hospitals for infectious diseases. Indonesia is pinning its hopes on China's experimental CoronaVac vaccine, being developed by Sinovac Biotech in Beijing. 1,600 Indonesians are taking part in ongoing clinical trials, but there are doubts about the vaccine's efficacy after early trials raised questions as to whether it produces a strong enough immune response. If it's approved, as expected, Indonesia will begin making the vaccine locally and rolling it out next year.
That's our Indonesia correspondent, Anne Barker. The social media giant Facebook has been accused of abusing its market power to crush its competitors. Trade regulators in the US have brought lawsuits against Facebook, which may be forced to sell its other social media and messaging platforms, Instagram and WhatsApp. The legal action is part of a growing campaign by regulators around the world against the might of big tech. Rachel Mealy reports.
Today's the day the war on Facebook officially began.
For nearly a decade, Facebook has used its dominance and monopoly power to crush smaller rivals, all at the expense of everyday users.
That's New York's Attorney General Letitia James announcing that lawsuits had been filed against Facebook in 48 states across America.
By using its vast troves of data and money, Facebook has squashed what the company perceived as potential threats. They've reduced choices for consumers. They stifled innovation. And they degraded privacy protections for millions of Americans.
The Federal Trade Commission is the US version of Australia's competition body, the ACCC, and it's overseeing the legal action. The lawsuits seek to break up Facebook's might by forcing it to sell the photo sharing app Instagram, as well as the messaging platform WhatsApp. They argue that Facebook's original purchase of both those platforms helped it remove potential competitors from the marketplace and concentrate its hold on user data.
But while consumers have been spending their time keeping in touch on Facebook, Facebook has been spending its time surveilling users' personal information and profiting from it. No company should have this much unchecked power over our personal information and our social interactions.
Amanda Lotz is from the Digital Media Research Centre at the Queensland University of Technology. She says the action is long overdue to curb Facebook's market hold.
Facebook is, in its core, an advertising company. And so the power that it has over companies that are trying to advertise in terms of setting the terms of how you can advertise, what you can do, and that there's really just no competition for that, right? And so I think we're in a situation, you know, we often think about, well, let the market decide, the market will lead, you know, to competitive conditions. But the situation is such that, you know, companies really can't choose to, you know, go somewhere else. There's not an equivalent to Facebook.
The lawsuits form part of a trend which has seen regulators and governments around the world finally taking a stand against the technology sector. In Australia, the government wants to pass new laws forcing Google and Facebook to pay news organisations for access to their journalism. Last month, the US Justice Department filed another antitrust lawsuit against Google. In that case, it argued that the company had struck special deals to expand its search and advertising empires. Professor Lotz says the world has been learning slowly about how to regulate the big tech marketplace.
It's just a matter of we've only recently gotten to a place in which we understand this with enough sophistication to be able to see what the core of the problem is instead of sort of waving our hands and saying, big tech, and as a result, also identifying what the particular solutions to those problems might be.
But there's no sign that all this will be resolved quickly. Facebook says the people of the world have benefited from its services and advertising and says it plans to vigorously defend its business practices. It means this could be in the courts for years to come, and we can all follow the news on Facebook.
That's Rachel Mealy reporting. Well, it's been a week when the threat of right-wing extremism has been front and centre. In southern New South Wales, an 18-year-old man is facing terrorism-related charges. In New Zealand, the Royal Commission into Christchurch massacre found gaps in the monitoring of right-wing extremism. And in Canberra, the federal government has announced an inquiry into the threat posed by right-wing terrorists. Reporter Mario Christodoulou spoke to Deakin University's Matteo Vergani, who's an expert in hate speech and violent extremism.
We actually do not have enough research to establish a predictive relationship between online hate speech and real-world violence. So we need more research to understand that.
And why is that a problem?
If we are able to predict real-world violence from online activity, we can improve our ability to prevent and mitigate the effects of terrorism and extremism. There is a lot of discussion about the idea of predictive policing. So is the police able to intervene before an attack happens? Well, and that's exactly the game that in Australia, most security agencies have played. Being able to establish a direct link between online activity and real-world violence will improve the ability of law enforcement agencies to keep us safe.
What do you think are the key gaps in our knowledge?
We need more data, basically, to understand this. So we need to be able to put together data from government agencies, non-government agencies like civil society organizations.
Why is data important in this area?
Well, because if we don't have data about what happens, both in the online and offline world, we are blind to the threat and we are not able to prevent incidents like the Christchurch attack. And from studying that behavior, we might be able to understand how to prevent future incidents that are similar.
Do we have any uniform collection of data on hate speech in Australia?
We do not. There is no comprehensive effort. It's important to remember that hate speech is often removed by platforms like Facebook or Twitter. So in that case, we are even blinder because we have no idea about all the amount of hate speech which is removed. And that hate speech might reveal something important for communities and security agencies to prevent acts of real-world violence.
What more do you think Australian governments could be doing to tackle the radicalization of people online?
Well, I think we need to do more research to understand what exactly is going on, and especially to do more research in partnership with online tech companies like Facebook, Twitter, of course, Telegram, and with communities. Because let's remember that communities are often the ones who keep an eye on online hate activity.
Are our security agencies adequately across the issue?
I would say that our security agencies probably need to, collaborate more with the research and the communities. There is a saying in terrorism research that says, look, researchers understand everything but know nothing because they don't have the data. And intelligence agencies know everything but understand nothing because they have a lot of data, but they do not have time to engage in meaningful research and blue sky thinking to understand, you know, the context
and the, you know, the predictive patterns between different types of behaviors, etc. So we need really to bring the two cultures, research and practitioners together, to work together to understand better how to prevent and mitigate the risk of violent extremism.
That's Matteo Vergani from Deakin University, and he was speaking with our reporter, Mario Christodoulou. That's all from the World Today team for this Thursday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along tonight, so tune in. Thanks for your company. I hope you can join us again at the same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sara. Stay safe and have a great afternoon.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Madeline Jenner, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. At the height of the pandemic, many lost jobs and plenty of businesses were forced to shut their doors.
Today on The Signal, the federal government says it wants to reform industrial relations laws to help employers and employees get through the COVID crisis. So how will the government's IR changes affect your job, and will it make a difference to your pay and conditions? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.